It's one thing to get married, but to create a marriage, it's a very highly creative project, because an intimate marriage is I know you and you know me, and who are we? We both have strengths and we both have limitations, but if we're invested, how do we work with those? That's how you create anything beautiful. You work with those raw parts, but it's a shared invested effort.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Welcome, everybody, to this live Q&A in which we're going to talk about ADHD and its impact in our most important relationships, and specifically marriage. And we have Camden Hainsworth with us. Camden is a certified ADHD coach, advocate, and educator who supports teens and adults navigating life, relationships, parenting, and belief through an ADHD lens. She received her ADHD coach certification through Kristen Carden's Focused program. Camden was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult and is raising four daughters in an intentionally ADHD-friendly home with her husband. And so Camden brings both lived experience and professional insight into her work. She's the founder of the ADHD Directory and the host of the Busy Brained Saint podcast. So welcome, Camden, to our discussion.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. Very excited.
Yeah, my pleasure to have you. So let me just pull up some of the questions that came in, and I'd love to just hear your thoughts about these things. I will be giving any insight I have in my work with couples, but I will be kind of leaning more on you to get sort of what your perspectives are, because I think I'd sort of like to learn as well from your experiences about how to think about these things. But this person writes, my therapist has been encouraging me to be tested for ADHD. What are some of the typical signs of ADHD? So maybe you could just start by explaining what it is. How do you know if it affects you and so on?
Absolutely. And before we even go there, because I know that there's a lot of people on this call that are partners and spouses of people with ADHD, I thought it might be important to also run you all through what I'm doing to advocate for my own ADHD brain on this call. And that means that we have looked at the questions, but I have also typed up notes, because memory recall is often really difficult for people with ADHD. And so I want to be calm. I want to be myself on this call. So that means that I'm going to be using my tools as well, even though I've been doing this for many, many years at this point. So hopefully to give more insight and compassion to the spouses who also struggle in a similar way. So essentially, ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder, and it's actually one of the most highly treated and effectively treated neurodevelopmental disorders that are out there. It impacts the prefrontal cortex, which is its main function is executive functions. People with ADHD are very interest-driven and interest-focused. And so the name actually is not great. Attention deficit hyperactive disorder. We don't have oftentimes an attention deficit. We have this ability to access so much that it makes it very difficult to focus on one thing. And so we have a sensitivity to many, many, many things. So the name is a little bit strange in that way. Many people with ADHD are impulsive, distracted. They get easily overwhelmed because of this dysregulation of sensory. Everything draws for attention. You might have worked harder. Like as you were younger, you felt like you had to work extra hard compared to your peers if you had ADHD. So to that question, if they're encouraging you, then there's probably a reason. And I would say, keep being encouraged by that. Because many of the times as well, our creativity, our out-of-box thinking allows us to hack it. We kind of are able to get around issues for a certain amount of time until we don't. And oftentimes in midlife, that's when things kind of start to fall apart, or if we have a life transition where things that we used to be able to hack before no longer work for us. And that can be really difficult. So I don't know what your circumstance is, but it sounds like it might be a good time to seek more education and more information about what you're experiencing, for sure.
The other thing I would say, Camden, and maybe I'm a little bit wrong in my thinking about this, but I think we live in a society now where all of us are a little ADD because it's such an information intense, distraction driven environment that people don't read books anymore. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, people's attention has actually been really harmed by the environment that we're in. And because we're so accustomed now to being kind of stimulated sort of moment to moment, people's ability to sustain attention has actually gone down. So that's one thought I have is that there's a lot of things about our environment that can make this worse or better. But I would also say that I slightly recoil at the disorder idea. I know that you didn't name it ADHD, that the APA did. But I think that, I understand that in a highly information-saturated society, that somebody who is more creative, more distractible, and so on, is going to be more noticed than they might have been in a more agrarian society where they're out there, you know, just picking potatoes or whatever. And so I think our environment has exposed the differences that don't fit well with the environment. But, you know, as a person, I don't know that I have ADHD, but I was definitely much more distractible growing up and so on. But I was also much more like a teacher would say something and my head would go and I'd be thinking about it and stuff. And then I kind of come back and realize I'd lost the thread because I was in my own head thinking about things. Yeah. But I think I was a much more creative thinker as a kid, a more abstract thinker. So I think it's not so much to pathologize it as it is to understand, like, we all have different ways of relating to the world and there's going to be these mismatches. And so how do we work with the mismatches and grow in our capacity to live in the world we're in and be able to accept our gifts and work with our limitations in that, you know, in that congruence or incongruence?
I just read a National Geographic article. They just put out an entire magazine on ADHD, and I was really curious what they had to say. And they did bring that up. Within the ADHD community, I would say that many people will get a little bit ticked off by saying, oh, I'm just a little bit ADD, because of how difficult it really does make living in our neurotypical society, whoever termed this as typical, right? And at the same time, that when we are seeking dopamine, when we are seeking, you know, scroll, it would be blind to say that that isn't impacting everyone's reality. And the frustration of being able to do something maybe better 20 years ago when technology was less available to us as to now. I love how you always say we need to take the holistic picture. We need to see the whole picture, not be so short-sighted about things. So, yeah, it's the research is out there, most definitely.
Yeah, and somebody asked, do ADHD symptoms get worse with menopause? And do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, I do. And yeah, if you are somebody that has a regular menstrual cycle, then you may have noticed it, but not actually attributed it to your menstrual cycle ahead of time. In that luteal phase, when estrogen drops, so does dopamine. And dopamine is a neurotransmitter that is really helpful in executive function. And so as estrogen continues to drop, as perimenopausal and menopausal, it's just going to be that, but times 10, you know, it's going to really be amplified during that time of your life. In addition to that, if you think of most people that are in menopause, a lot of their life has often shifted too. So the structures and the scaffolding of having children and soccer games and school, and, you know, whatever that might be, just having family life, you know, home life, when those structures are taken away, a lot of the time we lose our footing. And one of the things that typically speaking, people with ADHD aren't great at is creating their own structure. It's not to say that they can't. We think that we're like wanting a free-flowing life, but with the right kind of flexible structure, we actually can thrive a lot better. And so when that scaffolding, when that structure is removed, we feel very untethered. We feel very like we can't find our footing a lot of the time. So that, in addition to the hormones, would paint a very interesting picture as to why so many women right now are being diagnosed with ADHD and in their 40s and 50s.
This is so interesting. I'm just thinking about that. I'm just gonna like come clean and just say like I think I'm always in this struggle a little bit. Where I think always with every person I work with, or just, you know, with my own kids and things, or with myself for that matter, which is between like, how much does naming something help you address it versus naming something create something that's not real enough to worry about? Do you know what I mean?
Informs the subconscious. Yes. Preemptively
sometimes informs it. People will, too much. They'll make these jokes about with, oh, that's my menopause brain and stuff. And I mean, I'm sure that's very true for some people and for others less true. But also I sometimes, you know, there's always this balance between, you know, do you label somebody with on the autism spectrum? Does it help them get the services they need? Does it give them the self-awareness they need? Or does it make them feel like they're limited? And I don't always know what the balance
is. I think it's the maturity. Right. I think it's the maturity of this isn't an excuse. And I think another question actually points to that. But in my experience, there's always going to be something to grieve, especially if this is a new diagnosis or something you feel like, oh, I didn't know this about myself. There's some kind of future to grieve with that of like, oh, I thought my life was going to be a particular way and it's not. Mm-hmm. And then at what point can we say, okay, that was hard, but now how can it empower me? You know, ADHD, not as the excuse, but the explanation, and certainly not the end is usually how I like to say it. Like, let's explain what may be happening. And if that's the case, then what do we want to do about
it? How do you work with it?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As someone with ADHD, how can I help my brain slow down and stop spinning so I can be more present with my spouse? Once the kids are finally asleep and we get time to ourselves, I have a hard time not getting pulled away to do all those business things I couldn't get done while the kids were awake. By the time all of it is done, including talking about our days, it's often very late and leaves little time for physical intimacy. Meds seem to help throughout the day, but by night, I'm a scattered mess. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, I have... I have four young kids at home. My oldest is about to be 13, down to 4 years old. And so, I mean, this comment speaks to me and my clientele a ton.
Yeah.
Something that I have noticed in my clientele is whenever we're feeling overwhelmed, like a high percentage of the time when it's an ADHD symptom that's causing the overwhelm, I'm not talking about like a PTSD response or something like that. But when it's the ADHD symptoms, it's causing overwhelm. One of the greatest remedies is to seek for clarity. And I think this person, this is a woman, right? I believe so.
I don't know. I don't think they said.
It's fine. We'll pretend like this is a woman. Okay. And so when you're saying, you know, this is my go time, but I'm scattered and I want to connect with my partner. And how do I do this? How do I slow my brain down? Have you slowed down? Have you found a pause button? Do you even know how to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of mental training that can happen here where there might be some push on you as to what your evening expectation is, subconsciously versus what you actually want. And I would say that if you can get into clarity as to, okay, what actually is urgent and what is not urgent, and where does your connection with your partner land in that prioritization, and be more intentional about it, you're going to reveal some really interesting things to yourself. Finding the pause button is the absolute best thing that you can do in your life. I often will tell my clients, you can expect a lot of the time that sitting down to plan and write a list is going to feel like the least effective and efficient activity out of everything. And yet it is the thing that decreases our overwhelm, increases the ability to tap into that prefrontal cortex to make some really good decisions. And then I'm going to take it one extra step, which this is a little bit more of a hack, but a lot of the time the overwhelm is in the pursuit of not forgetting, because our brain is constantly trying to keep things top of mind. Don't forget, don't forget, don't forget.
Yeah.
We think that we have to do that in the moment instead of creating some kind of system or
some
accountability.
Way to hold that information. Yeah.
That's right. I call it a parking lot in my house, or a control center, or alarms on my phone. Like I put it, I will say, pay the bill, pay the parking ticket, you know, tomorrow at 9 o'clock with an alarm. And then I will have a second one just in case I forget it. And so that way, when I'm with my husband, you know, especially as we're becoming more intimate and we're really connecting, it's not like bloop, the parking ticket, you know, because we can expect that that will happen if we haven't outsourced a plan to our brain, because our brain really does want to take care of us. It's just not always great at organizing.
No, I think that's great. Like the strategies that allow us to put things aside. I mean, I think just going back to your sort of the initial idea there, which is, on some level, a decision around do I want to prioritize this time to be with, you know, to settle down, to have time with. And if that is a value to me, how do I make that possible? Even if my brain is a little like this when I, you know, get into bed or whatever.
And sure.
If I'm sorted, still doing that, I'm still making the decision that that is where I want to be. That's what I want to do. And so I like your idea of like, if that is what you want, then what are ways that I can, you know, what are strategies or processes that I can engage in that allow me to create somewhat of a boundary between all of my expectations and my to-do list and my ability to be truly present for a period of time, you know? And so it's in some ways just allowing yourself to, this is always an imperfect thing, but I think create a boundary and say, this is just time to be here. And then I think there is so much about just in the work I do with in relationships is that when we are anxious, we tend to get more scattered. Now, it depends on the person. People can do anxiety in different ways. But a lot of times our marriages make us more anxious than we think they should, or that being together may make us feel more anxious. So we may be a little bit scattered in part as well because of what we think is maybe not happening in the marriage, or what we think should be happening, or what we think we should be doing or feeling or whatever.
And now you have to face it because you made time to do that, right?
Because you made time. And so a lot of that may be coming up and it might be a lot easier to be thinking about the grocery list. And so, and so it might be also learning. I think the value of, like, you know, being on a yoga mat is like, okay, this is your time. Let all those other things go. It's like learning how to settle your body. I think part of intimate love is learning how to settle yourself down in that space together, because that is where people start to feel more connection, is when you're just settling down and finding a deeper presence. So it's just a valuable thing to do, not just for the marriage, but for your own soul, you know, for your own mind-body experience.
a couple people are asking in the chat, but what do you do when you have a list so long of the things you're trying to remember that you get so overwhelmed by it that you then avoid it?
I mean, that's reality, right? That's real life. Is your intention to write a list to make you overwhelmed? Or is your intention to write a list to help you have more clarity? And that actually is a choice in the way that I approach it. Is you can look at a list of long things, then you can notice the overwhelm, but you don't have to give in to the overwhelm. You can say, no, I'm actually more interested in gaining clarity here. And in so doing, it's going to be amazing when you're looking at this in a little bit more neutral emotion, what you're going to be capable of accomplishing. Now, all of a sudden you're seeing, okay, I like to start with my less than 5 minute tasks. I star those and then I clump them together and I make them into like a 30 minute chunk of time with five things or, you know, whatever it might be, because it decreases the amount of times I'm going to have to flip in and out of different things. And it allows me to approach them as one big chunk instead of like a big chunk, a small chunk, because transitions with ADHD are really difficult. That's my flavor of ADHD though. And I'm only able to understand how I can best make sense of this overwhelming to-do list if I have my head on straight. And we like to create drama because it's more exciting. And when we have more adrenaline and dopamine flowing through this with ADHD, we feel like, oh, this is more exciting. It's not so understimulating, when oftentimes doing a to-do list is very understimulating or overstimulating. And we're looking for that Goldilocks zone. So learning to get a hold of yourself and find a more neutral emotion while you're approaching something that might be bringing up some less desirable emotions is the first thing. And then trusting that your brain knows what to do. I guess another hack I can say, and then we can move on, I suppose, is I like to see my items by capacity and not by time. So, for example, maybe calling a new doctor actually is really anxiety-inducing for me. And having to find the phone number and then talking to the person and all the executive functions that takes. So that would be a high capacity sucker from me, versus a one might be actually painting a bedroom, because that is actually very calming. And so now I'm looking at capacity and priorities instead of just, okay, time elements. And then whenever I cross off something on my to-do list, it better be on my calendar with an alarm. That's the other thing for me, is that we don't have to keep everything on the to-do list until it's done, because I live by my schedule and my alarms and my phone and my Apple Watch. Like, that's an outsource of my prefrontal cortex. I cross that thing off once it's on my calendar, because I trust my future self that when that alarm goes off, I'm going to do it. But that's after years of learning to trust myself as well with ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like just what you're saying, which is this trusting that it's got a place that it belongs. Because otherwise, it just always eats at you. Like, should I do my laundry? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do that? And one of my kids who had an ADHD coach was like, no, you always do laundry on Saturday. You all, you know, just like give places to these.
Give them a house. Give them a home.
Yeah. Where they live. And then you don't have to carry it all the time. And I think.
Yeah. And I never would put that on my list unless it felt like extraordinary, like soccer uniforms, for example. Those need to be washed before the game. Or there are just some things that don't belong on the to-do list in my mind, because they're in a constant cycle. Those are things that are more like just that I make visual, or I communicate with my husband about roles in the home, just like eating dinner, you know, like, well, we probably will eat. And that's not to say we're never making a last minute decision about it, but we probably do remember those a little bit more. It's not a perfect science, guys. But like, that's why I said, if you can find some calm in it and not be so intimidated by it, I guarantee that you're going to be a lot more willing to try a few things out and to find something that does work for you. And not tie it to your worth. That's another big deal. Another big thing.
Yeah, I think what you're saying in that is just like, when the panic comes, I mean, there's strategies, but we can also just sometimes the panic of all the things that could go wrong, all the things we know we should do. And that sometimes it's also learning to just kind of, in some ways, just allow the feelings to pass through us and to kind of trust ourselves a little more. Yeah. That it's going to be okay ultimately.
Same fight, different day. Dr. Jennifer here. When conflict arises in marriage, as it so often does, it's easy for us to fall into our familiar patterns and then wonder why nothing ever changes. My Conflict and Connection workshop on June 20th in Alpine, Utah, will help you better understand how to change these patterns in your marriage so you can create more peace and connection. I've never offered a one-day couples workshop before, so this is a unique opportunity to come and learn in person without the time commitment or expense of a multi-day retreat. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
So this person asks, how do you support your neurodivergent partner without falling into codependency? And then I think this was another question. It's very similar. How does the neurotypical spouse not parent a neurodivergent spouse? Do we just have to let the chaos fly and deal with the fallout of not picking up the children at the agreed upon time, having zero clean dishes in the kitchen for a week, and the irresponsible impulse purchases? So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I would love to answer this one together because I think you know more about codependency than I do. However, I did kind of, I asked my husband a couple of things about this morning because the way that he grew up, even in, you know, how his mom had very traditional roles and what he's more naturally inclined to do, he's much more type A, he's neurotypical, is different than how I prioritize tasks. And yet I would say we have a highly functional marriage and that we have come to a place where dishes are no longer a threat and where a last minute dinner no longer means anything about him or about me or, you know, whatever it might be. It is never your job to parent your spouse. I think that goes without saying.
100%.
It's never your job to manage their emotions or, the thing, I'm going to go back to that flexible structure idea though, however, and if you want to self-evaluate, whoever asked this question, a good question is how rigid am I being in my expectations of this person achieving a goal, right? And how reasonable am I being with this? When I do house chores, it's like I'm doing a dance, man. Like, I'm all over the place and I come back in circles and cycles and it feels so great. And by the end of 7 days, a lot of the things I've accomplished would be the exact same things that my husband would accomplish, but mine looks different. You know, mine comes in a little bit more cycles. And a lot of the time we think of consistency in anything in neurotypical society as every 24 hours, we're doing the exact same thing, consistency. My consistency is like every 7 days or every 14 days. Like, am I touching on things more in this cycle? So is there flexibility? Is there room for that? And I actually was just listening to something. What did you say? I think I was listening to the, I can't remember. You said something like, people that love, people that are strong love, and people that are weak control. Mm-hmm. I heard you say that on one of these podcasts. Yeah. And I loved that because if you're seeking to control your spouse to manage your own anxiety about, oh my gosh, we're not going to have clean spoons, versus to love your spouse and to give them some flexibility to grow into that, those are two very different situations. Also, in our faith tradition, Sister Dennis, in her last conference talk, said, are we here to bear one another's burdens or heap burdens upon each other?
Yeah.
And I thought that also really spoke to this, that are we giving enough space for them to take ownership and let them move forward? And maybe in this circumstance, we're far past that. I don't know. I think that there's still a lot more room to grow on the neurotypical spouse to be a little bit more self-respected as well.
Yeah. So my thoughts on this are not fully settled, but I think when a marriage is functional, whatever the challenges are, even if one is struggling with mental health issues or has neurodivergence in a certain way that has, you know, has trackable limitations, right, in the day-to-day of life, the real question of a marriage is whether or not you have two people who take responsibility for themselves. Their strengths and their limitations. Because it's a very different thing to have somebody that sort of says, I can't help it, it's my ADD, okay? Or I can't help it, I'm type A, so I'm going to be a jerk about the dishwasher or whatever. You know, there's a kind of indulgence in either one of those postures that is about immaturity and dysfunction and creates a power struggle in the couple. When you're a collaborative couple, whatever your differences are, and they're going to be differences because that's how we tend to marry, is, you know, can I take responsibility for who I am and my impact and really work within the reality of who I am to do my part, to be fair? Not like I have to be like my spouse, but I want to limit my negative impact, right? I want to take responsibility for how I affect those around me, and not in a, oh, I'm so flawed and it's all my fault. Not that way, but just, okay, like, it's harder for me to be clean, but I'm married to somebody who's clean. And so what does that mean for me? That means I care about them, and therefore I'm going to try harder, even though I may never do it the way they do it. But the person that maybe is cleaner is like, look, I married someone that was different than me. I didn't want to marry somebody like me. That's the fair position. And so how do we love in the face of these differences? And to love is to accept and to care about them and to support them in who they are. And to love is to also, you know, work with the worst elements of your disposition, including somebody who's hyper-organized. Okay, that would also be very hard, or always clean, okay? So there's, you know, there's limitations and strengths in the diversity of who we are as people. And it's just learning not to use those things as an excuse. And so love is to say, how do I deal with these limitations in a way that's fair and kind? And when you see a spouse trying because they love you, that's a big deal.
Man, that's an intimate marriage. Like that's it takes some agency. It takes some choice to be willing to do it. To give up your own indulgence for somebody because you love them, or to at least try to do it imperfectly. Absolutely. And I always say it's kind of difficult to not have both people sometimes in front of me, because if the person with ADHD isn't coachable, then it's really hard for me to say what they should or shouldn't do. But assuming that they're willing, then that's a good sign for you. Assuming that there's some willing participation. I when I taught sixth grade, I taught elementary school for a little bit. My team teacher was very type A, very organized. She had been at the school for over a decade as the secretary, like the person at the head of the school. And so she knew the ins and outs. And I was brand new to the school. And by our third year there, I had no idea how to do any of the admin stuff, because she was always like 3 weeks ahead of me. And and it came to this point where I was like, it would probably be good if I knew how to do this. And I communicated that as, hey, I can get the permission slips to all the sixth grade parents, but it's going to be on a different timetable. It's going to be And that was very offensive to her. She's like, look at all the stuff I've been doing for you, et cetera. But I think about this in marriage, and I think about if she would give me some room to show up instead of being so hypervigilant and like anxious about it. Might it allow me to grow?
Precisely. Because I would say she struggles with collaboration.
Yeah,
more than she realizes. Okay, like sometimes the hyper functioner, the over functioner, is also struggling. They are managing their anxiety by getting everything done, you know, getting it, you know, rushing in and solving. Or another version of it, let's say you have a spouse that's depressed, or isn't dealing with their mental health issues or something. Well, very easily, the system can start to kind of revolve around that, support it, be less honest with the person who's having a negative impact. And that all looks like high functioning behavior by comparison, but it's also, it's the enabling idea. It's you're participating mm-hmm. in the problem by not allowing the person with the problem to own the problem, right? So in a collaborative marriage, you take 100% responsibility for what is your responsibility and 0% for what isn't, which sounds very unkind. But I mean, I don't mean you don't love. It is your responsibility to love and care and mm-hmm. accept, be honest with people that you love. But that's different than I'm going to go over and do what actually belongs to you, is actually on you to sort out your life. And when we are crossing over that boundary, it's usually that we're trying to manage anxiety or fear or a sense of needing to be needed through the boundary confusion, right? And so these are just very human issues. We all mm-hmm. get confused about these things. But when you add explicit challenges to a marriage, yes. it can make it harder to sort out what is loving, what is fair.
I often think of it as just another stepping stone into a normal life, right? So hopefully it's okay. I'll go here that my dad loved baseball growing up. Jim Abbott was a pitcher in the major leagues in the 90s, and he had one developed hand, right? So, but he was a pitcher. He threw no hitters. He played on the Yankees and the Angels, and he was amazing. If we were to say that he was to be coached and he was to go through baseball training and everything exactly the same way as all of his counterparts, his teammates, we would be a little delusional. We'd be living in a fantasy land, right? And so if you can think of, I'm not saying that we're all like have a hand tied behind our back, but if we can think of it, it's just an extra step, an extra lens to maybe look at playing baseball. They all played baseball. They all did. They all swung a bat. They all caught a ball. They all threw the ball. They all did it. When we bring in neurodivergence, we just have to see it a little bit more honestly as to what we're actually dealing with. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean that we stop playing baseball. And right. I think it's a really healthy way for us to approach this. It's not that we just stay and say, well, I guess I can't play sports. You know, I guess I can't do this. It's how. How then mm-hmm. do we access this? And what is it going to look for us? What's the training going to look for us? What's the practice going to look for us look like? It might be a little bit different, and that's okay, because it's going to allow us to get to the results that we actually want, which is yeah. life satisfaction, happiness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. There's so much we can do to live our lives better. And sometimes the most courageous thing is just taking it onto ourselves that I want to solve it. I want to figure out solutions for this, because sometimes we're in resistance even to our own challenges and not really sorting out how we're going to work with them. Okay, that's a similar question. How do I stay true to myself while also being a loving, supportive spouse to someone who has ADHD and PTSD? At what point does supporting someone turn into losing yourself or staying in situations that are no longer healthy for you? I want to understand what it really means to be a loving wife without overextending or sacrificing my own well-being. So maybe I'll just start with
please.
This one, Cannon. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, please.
I think that a real question to ask is the thing I'm doing making my spouse stronger, or is it making them more dependent? Is the thing I'm doing helping them to face their lives, helping them to find strength within themselves, or is it using me as a crutch? Does my giving it, even if it's hard, even if it means giving up other things that matter to me, still, I know it's the right thing to give, that I feel the honesty that it is what is actually asked of me right now, that it is the right thing to do? Or is it more about my anxiety or fear or the pressure I feel to not want to disappoint, or that I feel like I want to be helpful. And so just that immediate desire to be helpful means I go do it, but I actually feel like I'm giving too much and it's depleting me and it isn't making them stronger, right? You know, we often are doing things for myriad reasons. And sometimes those reasons are more about managing the pressure we feel from the other person, or our fear of disappointing, or that it's hard to see somebody struggle. And so we want to kind of run in and make them not struggle, but we're not actually dealing with reality, or we're not actually doing what is meat, you know, to use the scriptural idea, or to do what actually helps them develop the capacity in themselves. And so that's what love is. Love is to do what allows people to find their own strength. And so sometimes that means holding a boundary. Sometimes that means speaking honestly. Sometimes that means offering compassion, but not parenting or coddling, you know, a spouse. And so I do think sacrifice, when it's noble, actually makes us stronger. Even though it may mean we give up other things that matter to us, or that, you know, we feel some actual grief in having given up something that mattered to us, we know in our souls that we did the courageous thing. We know on some level it's what life was asking of us, it's what love was asking of us. But we have some peace with it. If resentment's there, usually we have another agenda operating, and that agenda is not being fulfilled. And so we resent. Like, I gave too much, I did too much, I thought you would love me, appreciate me, this problem would go away, whatever, you know, or I can't tolerate your disappointment, therefore I feel like I have to do it, but then I feel controlled by you. So those are the pressure points that push us on the question of what is actually loving here? What will help this person that I love thrive? And what's actually sustainable for me to give? And none of these are easy questions, but they are really at the core of sorting out what love is.
I love that. It's reminding me of just this idea of, if I'm resenting, then I must be expecting something from the other person. Like, they have to fulfill a particular need in me. Like, I have to be getting something in back. And I don't feel like a clean version of sacrifice would ask for anything in return.
Yeah.
And so I feel like resentment exposes a little bit more of a less clean version of serving
covert.
Sacrifice. Covert, yeah.
There you go. Covert contract of some kind. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think so. And again, all these things are normal. We do these things all the time. And it doesn't mean we can't be disappointed, right? It can be very hard to have a spouse disappoint us in a certain way, or to disappoint ourselves, or to wish we had capacities we don't naturally have, you know. Anyway, I'm remembering something one of my children said to me once. He was like, I wish I had Graham's limitations. He wished he had his brother's limitations.
Comparing.
But, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. Because those seemed easier than the ones he was looking at. So I think that, you know, yes, those things can all be hard, but it's sorting out what is actually the most right thing to do in this situation. And sometimes it's actually saying no. Sometimes it is. Okay, this question is, what should I do if I'm lonely in my marriage because I've never been able to truly connect with my autistic spouse? Do you feel this is a valid reason for divorce? It's a good question. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be understood there, and maybe it's broader than autism, because, you know, I think that it depends on the way that neurodivergence shows up. I personally, the way I make sense of autism is a struggle with mind mapping, but not a struggle with compassion. Now, you may have you may be married to somebody who is low on compassion and low on the ability to mind map. The opposite problem is like somebody who's psychopathic, right? They actually can be high on the ability to mind map. they can map what people want, but they're good at, you know, like somebody who's Machiavellian is very good at knowing what people want and exploiting what they want. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's low compassion, but high mind mapping. And sometimes people say what is autistic is a non-compassionate spouse. And I feel sort of protective of that because I have a child who's on the autism spectrum and he's quite high compassion, but low mind mapping. Timing on a joke is never on.
Yeah,
okay. So
never quite
there, right.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't mean that if you are with someone who's low mind mapping, they may not track your feelings. They may not track your emotions. I think women tend to be, as a group, tend to be very quick to kind of map the emotions in a room. And men, as a group, tend to be slower at that because their minds tend to be more linear, more testosterone driven, less corpus callosum in the brain. So so men are often not cluing in to the subtle cues in a room like women are. And so in those differences, in those brain differences, people can feel lonely or they're looking for different things from their spouse than what they're getting. I think the question I would have is it an aloneness of just being with somebody who does the world differently, who's not there to validate or kind of talk to you in the way that some friends might? But you know they care about you. You know they love you. You know they're invested in you. They want you to be well, but you're not able to share in every experience. Or is it, it's a low investment, low engagement marriage, right? And they're not interested in a marriage, right? They're not interested in a friendship or you're not able to build a bridge to the differences and have a friendship there or create a friendship there. So for me, it's not so much about that a good marriage means your spouse understands everything about you. I mean, I share all kinds of experiences with other people that I don't share with my spouse as much. He's just not as into some
engaging
of the things that I,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I care about sharing with my sisters or friends. And that's totally okay in a good marriage. It's like just knowing what the relationship is. And do we have something here that's real and honest and invested, even if doesn't fulfill every desire for connection in me? And is it that my spouse is not capable of it or that they don't want it, right? So I think those would be questions to consider around the viability of a marriage.
Yeah, I would say that I don't think that the neurodivergence disqualifies the connection. Yeah, that's not the disqualifier or the qualifier. So like you're saying, bring it to the next step. What's the deeper thing? There's a person that has neurodivergence. And what is the person with neurodivergence willing to experience? And if they are putting in the effort, then it brings you to the deeper question as to where can we bring this relationship? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This person said, this is maybe similar to the overfunctioning underfunctioning. My spouse has often cited his ADD as the reason he can't follow through with his verbal commitments. In my mind, which is neurotypical, this seems like an excuse. Is it reasonable to assume that he has the ability to figure out how to follow through with his commitments? Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, we kind of talked about it before. I see ADHD, and I think on the podcast that you and I did, you put it really nicely that sometimes a compartment or a box of similar attributes is helpful to help us understand different brain types and different life situations. But if we are limited by that box, then right. Where is growth? Where is life satisfaction? And so ADHD is there as a box, a compartment to help us understand ourselves a little bit better, but not to hold us to a particular limitation. So it's not an excuse, it's an explanation. And once again, we don't explain to the end of that explanation. We explain to the end of growth and prosperity and progress.
Right. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So I think, if that couple were working with me, I would be, I guess I would be interested in the question is this a person, is the person asking the question just too rigid, like, just can't handle anything going wrong? and or is the person with ADD like really kind of underinvested, blowing off important commitments, like not showing up to pick up the kids, you know, not doing things that really matter. So first of all, what's happening? What's
responsibility wise? What's
exactly? And then is the person that's struggling with the commitments, do they want to do better? Like, do they want to do better and they need the strategies and they need ways to think about and they need a little more understanding
flexibility
on the side
and
of their
compassion.
Spouse? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, or are they using ADD as an excuse to not be invested, right? Because I have certainly seen that too. So
yeah, to put up a wall. I was thinking about, as I was talking with my husband too, there came a point like 2.5 weeks ago where I said, hey, right now in my business and what's pulling on me, would you be willing to just take on the laundry? Could you do that for me? And that was like an honesty about my own ADHD that in this small chapter of our life was really good for me to say, you know what? I know we both need clean laundry and so do the kids. And normally we can handle this together, but can we just for the next little bit, just give it to you? Mm-hmm. And that is informed by the experience I'm having with my ADHD and what is actually triggering me to have anxiety, et cetera. But it's not this excuse of, oh, I can't do it or I'm incapable of doing it. It's more of this collaborative effort of,
yes,
probably can we just switch up some of the responsibilities to make our family and our home life make more sense for our particular strengths and challenges at the moment. And sometimes it's, oh, you're the wife, you need to know how to do the dinners, or you're, you know, we go into these really rigid expectations, or, okay, I'm doing 3 dinners and you're doing 3 dinners and that's an equal marriage. When I think that's very short-sighted a lot of the time. And I, you know, I feel even silly saying that aloud, but this comes up a lot in my coaching is just the rigidity of the expectations, the fairness type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than collaborative is who are you and who am I and how do we make a marriage? How do we make a family? Mm-hmm. How do we make a life? Yeah. And so it's, I often talk about this is that it, really a marriage, when you really, you know, it's one thing to get married, but to create a marriage, it's a very highly creative project because an intimate marriage is I know you and you know me and who are we? And we both have strengths and we both have limitations. And but if we're invested, how do we work with those? That's how you create anything beautiful, right? And so you work with those raw parts, but it's a shared invested effort. Okay. Do you have any last thoughts before we stop and maybe just remind people where they can find you and anything else you'd like to add?
I think the one we didn't really talk about that maybe we can speak to really quickly is just the sensory and intimacy thing of like my partner or spouse has ADHD or autism. And so sensory things are really difficult. Can we expect to have a healthy sexual intimate relationship? And I would just say, yes, you can. Mm-hmm. Once again, as we've spoken to it, that neurodivergence does not disqualify you from any kind of life satisfaction, but it does add an extra layer. And as you're collaborative, just like Dr. Jennifer was saying, you're going to be able to work through that as you're giving yourself to that. And there is a resource. Ari Techman has a book called ADHD After Dark. And they did a lot of research. It was a neurotypical and a ADHD spouse. And, they found that sexual satisfaction was equally as possible, you know, for that kind of combination as anyone else. So if you wanted to use that as a resource, it could.
Remind us of what that resource is. It's called?
Yeah, it's called ADHD After Dark by Ari Techman. And I actually do have a free resource guide on like my favorite ADHD resources and books on my website, CamdenADHDCoaching.com/books. You guys can go take a look at that. I've just kind of had a splattering of, you know, parenting versus adult versus partner versus compassion versus inspiration. I kind of put them out there because there are so many resources out there now. Yeah, I think it's good, a good starting place at least.
That's great. Yeah, and I mean, just as speaking as somebody who loves many people with ADHD, you know, or somewhere on that spectrum. I mean, just some of the most brilliant, creative,
yes,
sensitive, artistic people. I mean, so I don't know. I just think,
it's the best people, man.
The best
clientele. It is always a party, and they get on, and you go deep, fast, yes, and honest, and raw, and you see what you're going to get, and you can be. It is so beautiful to get to know. Yeah. People with neurodivergence, it is the greatest gift.
And if
you can, and I know that it's challenging. I parent ADHDers, I have ADHD, so I don't want to diminish that. And I feel like the work that you put in, so long as they are willing to grow, the equal partnership in this growth, it is so rewarding to know oneself so intimately and to share that with other people, for sure.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So, okay. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks for being here. And thanks for coming on, Camden. Really appreciate your insight and your perspectives.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.